Busy show to kick off a brand new week on Monday, April 19th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. New Canaan Republican State Rep. Tom O'Day joined us at the bottom of the 3 o'clock hour to update us on what was going on the Connecticut State House floor regarding debates surrounding a controversial bill that would get rid of the religious exemption for mandatory vaccines in the state. We got the latest from Governor Ned Lamont just after 4 p.m. on the coronavirus. We talked to two women behind a victims' rights group in the 5 o'clock hour, not happy with the some parts of a clean slate bill being debated in Hartford. And also, our buddy, our pal, former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso called in to give us his thoughts on a law that has been working pretty well, one he helped author, that would take away municipal pensions from folks who are convicted of wrongdoing. That's what's currently being debated in the cases of former Bridgeport Police Chief A.J. Perez and the city's Director of Personnel, David Dunn. Let's go to Chris Caruso, who's joining us this afternoon. Hello, Chris. What is up with you?
Well, Paul, I wanted to change topic a bit.
Sure. You got a couple of minutes. Yep.
Yeah, it was in the Connecticut Post today.
Mm-hmm,
the Post did a review of 26 cases, the Attorney General for the state, civil cases against public officials who violated law, felonies, and were convicted. And of the 26, 16 people were revoked their pensions. The judge revoked their pensions, state or municipal pensions. And I thought that was pretty telling.
Sure.
There's three pending, which includes Perez and Dunn. And there were, I think, three people that their pensions were reduced. And there was one that didn't answer it. It was a worker comp fraud case. And I think it's still pending. And then there were another two that the court denied. But it shows that the statute is working.
Good.
That, you know, public and employees and public officials who commit felonies and are convicted run the risk of their pension being revoked.
And doing that, Chris, you wonder what they are thinking for the future of their husband or wife or kids. I mean, they've got, you know, who knows what goes on in the minds of a human being, Chris, but if they're in a position where they're going to be pulling, you know, a $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year pension, what are you doing? Don't you have kids and a wife that, God forbid, if something happened to you, you would still be able to provide for them? Chris, I don't get it, and I never have.
No, I don't think there's an easy answer to it, Paul. I think each person is different, and the reasons they engage in the crime are probably different, but I think the good thing is that there's that deterrent in place that, you know, if you do violate the law and felonies, which are serious crimes, then you run the risk of your pension being revoked. And I know often people criticize government, but in this case, we see 16 of the 26 cases where the full pension has been revoked. What's that percentage-wise, Paul? Is that what, 65%?
Yeah, it's got to be. So, Chris, in about the 30 seconds we have left, do you like the way the process is set up to do this?
Well, I am, because I'm the one who created the law.
That was a setup question, Chris.
Was it? Okay, all right. And no, of course I am. I'm not happy that people's pensions have to be taken, but I think it's also important to have strong deterrence, to let people think before they commit these crimes, especially for the public trust and the public good, you know?
Absolutely.
But it is working, and that's see that the courts are taking it seriously, that, you know, those people who have committed these crimes are being punished accordingly, you know?
What's your gut feeling, Chris, on what will happen with Mr. Dunn and the former chief? Care to prognosticate on that or not?
As to what will happen with their pension?
Yeah.
Well, I think there will be some action taken. I don't think they're going to walk away from this clean. Either they get the pension reduced or they get it fully revoked. And, you know, we gave the court in the law some discretion because in some cases, let's say a person who commits the crime has younger children that had nothing to do with the crime. You know, you got to be cognizant of that. But, you know, in these two cases, we'll see how it plays out, but I think it's going to be a reduction, a serious reduction, or it could be a full revocation of the pension, especially a police chief. You know, the court may want to you know, send a message that people in law enforcement, especially in high positions like that, have to think twice, you know?
Chris, thank you. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso. What's going on with this bill that may, if it passes both chambers, get rid of the so-called religious exemption on vaccines in the state, something opponents say is really not necessary if you look at the numbers, something supporters say is necessary in light of what we've gone through with COVID and measles a couple of years ago. New Canaan Republican State Rep. Tom O'Day is with us for a return visit. Tom, Paul here. How are you?
Good, Paul. How you doing? Taking a break from the debate right now to kind of inform your listeners where we are.
Okay, so the vote has not happened yet, right?
Well, we did amend. There was an amendment, a bipartisan amendment, to expand the religious exemption from 7th grade to 12th grade currently to basically kindergarten through 12th grade. If you currently have a religious exemption now from kindergarten through 12th grade, you will be allowed to continue to go to school with that religious exemption. Anybody pre-K or obviously earlier or hasn't been born yet will not be eligible for a religious exemption going forward.
So you put in essentially a grandfather clause in there, Tom. Is that what I'm getting here?
Exactly. Now, there was a number of R's and D's that were opposed for different reasons. Some of the D's were opposed to the further grandfathering because they don't want any grandfathering. They don't want even 7th grade through 12th grade grandfathered. They want everyone vaccinated or you're out of school. And some Republicans were opposed because we shouldn't be touching with people's religious freedoms at all. And just expanding a bad bill is bad policy and unconstitutional anyway. So I did vote for it. There's roughly 800 kids per grade that are claiming religious exemption. Mm-hmm. And I should point out, Connecticut has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. And you heard that right. Connecticut is somewhere between 1 in 5 in vaccination rates in the entire United States. And for some reason, my good colleagues on the side of the aisle are looking for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah, and Tom, I've also, in talking to a lot of legislators, I'm finding out, number one, what you said is there's not some alarming trend here that everybody is screaming at to do this. And also, Tom, number two, you know, we hear about that 800 per grade or about 8,000. But, you know, Heather Summers from the Senate side told me something last week that I have been doing further reading on, is it's actually higher because of simple non-compliance in some of the urban areas in the state as well. But, you know, there are some people, I guess, Tom, that tend to turn a little bit of a blind eye to that. That number I see could be as high as 30,000 for other reasons.
And, Paul, you're exactly right. I was going to try and get to that. You beat me to the punch. We believe there's somewhere around 20,000, 22,000 people who are children, school children who are non-compliant simply because they haven't gone to the doctor and for whatever reason their parents have not gotten them vaccinated. So you're exactly right. We need to do more. I think a bigger impact would be education for those people who are non-compliant for no reason other than simply not going to the doctor and having their child immunized. Attacking the religious freedoms of the 8,000 we think is the wrong way to go, particularly in light of the fact that we have one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. And we believe, you know, school districts that may be below, there was some talk during debate that about 120 schools are below the 95%. But remember, 95% is for measles, which is highly contagious. Mm-hmm. The herd immunity threshold, or HIT, is much lower for most other diseases, you know, in the 80s percent. And so we are well above that for all of the other diseases that the children are given shots for.
All right, Tom, thank you. Go grab a power bar and carb up and calorie up for the rest of the day up there in Hartford, and be good. We appreciate
it.
Tom O'Day, Tom, thank you. Thanks. Be good, Tom. Tom O'Day, State Rep. Tom O'Day, New Canaan Republican. He said they're on a break from the debate. which may last a few more hours before a vote. So there you go, folks.
And Tim Restall, he is the president of the Yard Goats, Connecticut's professional baseball team. And we're getting back to baseball. We'll talk about that in just a minute. First, the COVID, not daily summary, but it's since going back since Friday. I think the good news you see on this chart is that unlike Michigan, unlike Idaho, unlike some places where there could be a bit of a spike, as they've seen, not in Connecticut, not in our region. We continue to have a positivity rate, less than 3%, lowest that we've been now in a month on the seven-day average. Hospitalizations are pretty stable. Fatalities, tragically, you can see we surpassed 8,000 deaths. 8,000 deaths over the last year. Next up, but we're doing relatively well and flattening the curve when it comes to infections, when it comes to hospitalizations and fatalities, because people are getting vaccinated. We're doing very well on that front. You probably saw the United States was celebrating, you know, yesterday that over 50% of their adults, our adults, had been vaccinated. Well, our adults in Connecticut is not 50%, it's 61%. All of you have had at least your first dose, all of you over the age of 18. That's extraordinary good news. 65 and above, they're the champion age group. 88% have been vaccinated. Gives you some confidence that if we can move those other numbers up for the 18 to a 44-year-old age group, we will have herd immunity and be back to a really great summer. And so far, the numbers look good. You know, Josh has told me some of the mobile vaccination vans, they have some extra vaccines at the end of the day. It's worth checking. It's worth stopping by. There are same-day appointments. You can go online, and you'll find there are appointments available. You may have to hunt and peck depending on where you are, but there is more capacity now, and here's your chance to get vaccinated. That means we have to work a little harder to make sure each and every one of you gets vaccinated, and that's why we have a partnership with 144 community partner organizations doing outreach, knocking on doors. We have the LEAP organization knocking on doors, telling you to get vaccinated, how to get vaccinated, bringing vaccines for those who are homebound, also telling people about the summer camps and other programs going forward. Working with the large not-for-profits, Red Cross, Salvation Army, community centers, faith-based organizations. I love the front page of the Hartford Current today about two sisters, Muslim sisters. Headline was, "They trust me." You have to have trusted advocates going out to the Muslim community and getting people vaccinated. Young sisters take the lead is the headline. Thank you for what you're doing. Our mobile vans continue to bring the vaccine to you. And you can see here 10 mobile clinic destinations, you know, Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, New Britain, Waterford, East Hartford. And you say, hey, these are all the big cities. Well, A, these are where we have a lot of socially vulnerable populations. Really important we bring the vaccine there. And we've been to an additional 26 smaller towns, really making sure that we get the vaccine to you. This chart, little an eye chart, I appreciate it. Give you an idea where the vaccination mobile vans have been. Again, the Naugatuck Valley, you can see that a little bit in and around New London, Norwich. But we're making pretty good progress. You don't need an appointment. You can just stop in. And if you don't know, want to find out when the van's going to be in your area, just contact your first selectman. Go to the mayor's website. You'll be able to find out there. So that all leads us to our business restrictions and continuing to slowly, cautiously, and safely reopen our economy. And that started on May 20th last year, we did for outdoor dining. So now, starting May 1st, which I think is a week from Saturday, a couple of things. One, we have an 11 o'clock curfew, move that back a little bit to midnight. Gives restaurants an opportunity for second seating, which they greatly appreciate. Makes us parallel with what's going on in New York State, certain symmetry there. In outdoor restrictions lifted, alcohol without food allowed. That sounds a little like a bar where you can sit, have a drink without necessarily having to have a meal right now. you know, strongly recommend being outside. I think May 1st, you're going to find it a lot warmer, being able to do that outside. And no table size limit. We were, you know, capped at 8. We're going to lift that as well. You know, continue to be cautious with the mask. Obviously, if you're having a cool frosty, you don't have to wear a mask. If you're able to socially distance, you don't have to wear a mask outside. But otherwise, stay cautious on that. And then moving forward a few weeks to May 19th, at that point, we're going to essentially end all the remaining business restrictions. And what does that mean? That means the social distancing will be relaxed. It'll be guidance. It'll be up to you and your restaurant how you want to do it, keep people safe, but no mandates from us. The curfew, we'll lift that then, 12 o'clock curfew. Use your discretion from there. Gathering sizes, we have limits on gathering sizes, indoors and outdoors. Outdoors is 100. That's going to, we'll relax that. There won't be any gathering size limitations after May 19th. And movie theaters, right now they're capped at 50%. They'll be 100%. And at that point, you know, I think there won't be any requirements regarding masks outside. We still strongly recommend wearing the mask inside unless you've been vaccinated. We'll find some balance there that makes pretty good sense. I think these are all ways that we have earned the right to get back to our new normal. And I think you see on May 1st, there's going to be a little more outside fun, which I appreciate as long as we're careful. And on May 19th, we're, you know, back to our new normal. You know, with that, let me just say the Yard Goat Stadium has been a vaccination center for some months. They've been incredible community supporters for us, the Yard Goats. And stadium, and pretty soon, May 11th, I think it is, Tim, going to start playing baseball. And Tim's here to tell you a little bit about what that means, why I'm so proud that we've been doing the vaccinations. We've earned the right to a live baseball game in person. I plan to be there. Tim?
Governor, thank you. Well, as someone that watches this every week, and as a father and as a husband, and a son and an employee in a company, I'm excited to be here today and to hear this news. You know, it's the Yard Goats. We've always said it's been more than baseball. And about 12 weeks ago, the city of Hartford had reached out to us and said, can you host a vaccination site at the ballpark? And we said, absolutely, yes. And it's been a great process. It's been a team effort. And it's taking our staff, the city of Hartford, and everyone involved to be able to help us get back to this phase. So I can't stress how important it is to be able to get vaccinations and get back to a new normal. It's, you know, when May 11th comes around and that first pitch is thrown, it'll be 621 days since the last time the Yard Goats have taken the field. So here at Dunkin' Donuts Park, we are preparing for fans to come back into the ballpark. We put our tickets on sale next week for individual tickets, and we're excited to welcome everyone back to our home to be able to, you know, cheer on the Yard Goats, see the shots in the arms going on, and also getting shots outside the ballpark. So thank you so much for having me here today, and it's exciting time.
Thanks, Tim. Leave that up for 1 second. Steam Burgers, Hartford. I love that in the background. We've been fussing about pizza. What's our estate food? Steam Burgers, that's ours. We should remember that. And the Hartford Yard Goats. No goats, no glory. All right, let's take your questions.
NBC Connecticut.
Happy Monday, everyone. Governor, regarding the loosening of restrictions for May 19th, I just want to be clear on this. So all restrictions go away, save the indoor masking, no mandates, just recommendations. So as in bars and clubs can open indoors with no capacity, Yard Goat Stadium can open to full capacity?
That's right. I'm going to I think we're going to mandate that you continue to wear the mask in school through the end of the school year. It gives students and teachers and parents confidence there. I'll have a discussion with the legislature about that. And probably we're going to require indoor masking a little bit longer unless you're vaccinated in, you know, crowded public places. But that's it.
And in terms of vaccinations, how would that go about? Like, do people need to be vaccinated to go to a Yard Goats game? Is there any sort of requirements on that end that's been discussed?
No. No, there are no requirements on that. You know, different venues may have their own rules, but there are no requirements there.
And then, you know, days after the J&J pause, Hartford had noticed a lower amount of walk-ins at one of their pop-up clinics. Are you noticing that around the state? And then also just wondering what's the latest with the J&J news as well?
We are noticing a little less demand on some of our mobile vans, as I said before. That may be because we're supply and demand or a new mix, maybe a little bit of hesitancy related to J&J. I think J&J, I just heard Dr. Fauci, like everybody else, he expects a decision probably by Friday, certainly this week, I hope.
Thank you so much.
Fox 61.
Hello, Governor. Quick question for you. We announced today that, you know, we are expecting students to be back on campus in the fall. We just heard from Wesleyan last week, Yale this week, that they are going to be mandating that students who go to campus get vaccinated. Do you see Connecticut as, you know, with our public universities, making any of those mandates?
Not yet, Amanda. You know me, I just said we got 88% of our people in the older age group vaccinated. If we could do this on a voluntary basis, we will. But if we can't, we'll have to make up our mind on that a little bit later this summer.
Thank you. And one other question for you, a little off topic. We just heard about the 19-year-old being arrested in that awful case where the 3-year-old died in Hartford. There have been calls to your office and just, you know, with state leaders to get more funding for violence prevention programs, some specifically targeting youth. What do you think as a state we can do to, I don't want to say completely solve this problem because it, who knows if it can be completely solved, but do things to help this process?
Yeah, Amanda, we provided significant funding for our not-for-profits like Project Longevity down in New Haven over the course of the last year, and we are going to double down on our efforts there. We're going to do everything we can to make sure you have the services, the wraparound service, along with the police protection to do everything we can to keep you safe.
Thank you.
NBC Connecticut. News 12, Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. Since people under 16 won't be vaccinated, but their, you know, parents and older siblings will be, are you going to suggest that if they're at a business or at an event, that masking is more important for the non-vaccinated younger set?
I would urge them to be cautious, absolutely. Maybe they don't suffer particular complications from COVID, but they can certainly transmit it and potentially infect others. And I'm going to do everything we can. We got to limit the infection because every time there's another infection, there's another chance for a variant. So we're going to watch that very carefully.
And do you have specific goals with this latest set of business restrictions being lifted? And is there any portions of it that give you the most concern or want for caution?
Yeah, when you have drinking outdoors and without much of a curfew, there's room for a less careful behavior. But I really think this is the time we can do this. I think we can do it safely. And because we're doing it outdoors, I have a great deal of confidence. We're going to be in May. I think it'll be really comfortable to be outdoors and safe to be outdoors.
All the stuff going on in Hartford that seems miles away for you folks that could end up affecting you is what we do with giving some folks a second chance. There's a clean slate bill that is being debated among all the other bills, marijuana, gambling, vaccinations in Hartford. To what length do we extend the authority and the practice that's already there to a small extent? But do we extend wiping away criminal records from some people of several misdemeanors, some felonies as well? And one of the groups that has significant problems with parts of this bill is violent crime survivors. Now, you can go online. Their website is vcsurvivors.org, violentcrimesurvivors.org, vcsurvivors.org. We're joined today by two guests here, Michelle Voigt and Jen Lawler, both joining us on the program here, and both have voiced their opposition as part of that group to what's going on in Hartford. Michelle and Jen, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, let's, you know, now, Michelle, let's start with you so people know why you have some opposition here, some concerns, and where you're coming from on this, Michelle. So why are you so vocal about this, Michelle? Tell us your story.
This bill has some really good intentions to address mass incarceration in the state of Connecticut. However, it's just laden with societal collateral consequences that people just don't know about. This bill would not just seal a criminal record from someone who's served their time, waited a few years after. Typically with parole, you would apply for parole. This calls for an automatic erasure of a criminal record. And, Paul, this includes felonies. So this goes up to C, D, and E felonies. The only thing that's not included in this erasure or clean slate bill is violent and nonviolent sexual offenses and family domestic violence.
So Michelle, let me let people know, if you could explain, why do you have a concern about this? Why did you get involved in this? A little background of your personal story.
So I have been working and supporting survivors of gun violence specifically through Every Town and Moms Demand Action in Connecticut for 3 years. And working with survivors and victims, I came to realize how they are disregarded and left out of the legislative process. These are people who are already traumatized and beaten down and don't typically have the wherewithal to speak for themselves or ascertain the information of what's happening in Hartford. So they basically, their rights were being trampled on, and they were not finding that out until they were just devastated within the judicial, the criminal process.
Jen Lawler, let's switch to you, Jen. Before I ask for your views on what's going on, which I would imagine align with Michelle's, what is your personal story here for being involved in this, Jen?
Thank you. I've actually been working with Michelle for quite some time. She is both my friend and is also an advocate for me as a survivor of violent crime. My daughter, Emily, was killed in December 2018 here in Connecticut by a dating partner. And my life that I used to have is just no more. And a great deal of the last 29 months of my life has revolved around dealing with the criminal justice system. So the things that you learn when they are right there in your lap are much, much different than what myself included, could have ever imagined were the actual truths of the criminal justice system.
Jen, let me ask you, let me stay with you for a moment here. This all sounds good on the surface, a clean slate bill. We always say, well, we're a second chance society. I've always believed that. I'm sure you might too, to some degree, to some level. White-collar crime, you know, some crimes that don't necessarily cause bodily harm. They may cause financial harm, but that can always be remedied. What are your feelings now, having gone, Jen Lawler, through what you and your family have gone through, and how does that reflect on your attitude to what we're seeing here in this bill?
Well, I can tell you that, for one, I do support clean slate, you know, for crimes, as you mentioned, that don't involve a human victim, where there hasn't been violence or harm committed against anybody, but maybe the person themselves. And I say that because I'm referring to even drug crimes. A lot of what needs clean slate and having a look at are these are crimes against yourself when you're arrested for drug possessions and things of that nature. So I do think, like Michelle said, the bill has some good intentions with that. But where, you know, my antennae goes up is that I know very well that the crime committed by somebody is not what it looks like when they are in front of a judge and then actually sentenced. Our offender has not yet been sentenced. That's a whole different situation on what's going on in Connecticut. But I know all about the plea deal process. I know all about how, you know, certain charges get thrown out. Everything gets bundled together. It's like a human being is put on a roulette wheel.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very terrible way to interact with victims of crime. And so, as Michelle said, with some of the felonies that are included, we cannot do a blanket clean slate without having an individual look at some of these felonies, because many of them, you know, after a plea deal, they may look like something on a piece of paper, but the real nature of the crime committed was terribly violent.
Michelle, back to you for a moment before we take a break. I want to dovetail what Jen just said. I've had some state legislators on, Michelle and Jen. Michelle, they've brought up exactly what Jen just did, that you cannot with a broad brush, perhaps in a lot of situations, especially when you're dealing with low-level felonies, just make a generalization that'll be wiped clean or this will be wiped clean. And I know they have issues with that, and I'm sure you do as well. And some of the ages, the age level here involved, Michelle.
Right. Here's part of the problem, too. It's not just like wiping the record clean. It's destroying all the evidence that was involved in the case or the conviction. So all documents are erased automatically. Without a conversation with the victim, the survivors, or even the prosecuting DA who oversaw the case. A crime is very personal. It's very specific, especially when you get into violent crime and physical crime. And victims have very few rights in the state of Connecticut. And this directly violates their constitutional rights to not have notice, to not be able to address the situation, to not have their voice heard, is a violation for people who have already been so traumatized and victimized by the system.
All right, Michelle, hang on. We'll be back to you momentarily. Michelle Voigt and Jen Lawler are the guests from Violent Crime Survivors, vcsurvivors.org. Ladies, hang on. We'll be back. I want to get deeper into this, including ask you about what you have heard from individual legislators. First, traffic and weather together at 516 on WICC. Admittedly, we live in a second chance as far as some politicians go, second, third, fourth chance society. But there is great concern now among the survivors and family members and friends of violent crime victims that the so-called clean slate bill being bandied about in Hartford is just too broad or too narrow, depending upon which way you look at it, and needs to be looked at in a different way with changes made. Jen Lawler and Michelle Voigt are joining us for the next few minutes. Again, vcsurvivors.org, vcsurvivors.org. Michelle, let me go back to you for a minute. When things like this happen, when we have these contentious bills, one thing I always find fascinating, and I like to ask people about, and I'll ask you, what reactions do you get from legislators when you say, hey, listen, the basic concept of this is okay, but this is really bad, this specific spot or two or three in our minds? What do they tell you?
You know, I've advocated for different legislation for different purposes over the course of time. I have to tell you, with this specific bill, the response is very different. There seems to be an unwillingness to listen to survivors of violent crime and victims It seems to be very one-sided. A lot of people have participated in the crafting of this legislation over time. As you may know, this was to be brought up, I believe, a year ago, before COVID. And so there's been a lot of people invited to the table to help craft this legislation. And it's really appalling to me that survivors of violent crime were not invited to the table.
Jen Lawler, Jen, I know that there was some controversy here, and highlight this for our audience here. First, the age of cutoff, as it were, for some of this erasure was 21, and then it was 25, and then back to 21. What about that whole age thing?
Well, I believe, and Michelle can correct me, the age concern, which is enormous, is a whole separate bill that's been raised, which the people that raised the legislation were looking to change the age of what's considered, Michelle, you may want to take this one, and knowing right from wrong, they wanted to raise it all the way to 25, mm-hmm. basing it on saying that people's brains aren't developed enough to know the difference enough and have full responsibility for their crime. It did not get out of judiciary at the age of 25, but it did get out of judiciary at the age of 21 to start modifying the amount of time served for very, very violent offenses based on the person's age when they committed the crime. Michelle, I don't know if you want to add something to that.
Yeah, Michelle, do you want to add?
It's correct. It adjusted so that adult offenders are now treated as juveniles, and it's retroactive too. So it will include people who have already been in the process or plea deals have already been written. It's arbitrarily like drawing a line in the sand. It's saying that because of a certain age that you should be treated differently, and we've taken a position on this bill as well. We don't believe that if you're 20 and commit murder, or if you're a violent rapist, that your sentencing and your right for parole should be any different than if you were 22.
Jen, final question for you as we wrap up here. One of the most distressing things on this bill that has been told to me directly by legislators who, like you ladies, have a problem with it is, and you alluded to this earlier, what facts of cases are still going to be around for the record? I mean, people say, well, we're going to tear this stuff up, but you can't erase, if you forgive me, what happened. I mean, and I know legislators have told me there's even some concern about what prosecutors, if these people are involved in future crimes, what they can take a look at. Is that true?
Absolutely true. They can't take a look at anything. It's erased. It's gone. There's no evidence. There's no record.
Including the, yes, everything from the police department, their evidence box, whatever it is, everything destroyed, gone, as though it never happened.
Ladies, to me, that's mind-numbing, but we'll have to save that for a different day. Jen Lawler and Michelle Voigt, thank you so much for your time. My family has been touched by violent crime, too, in the past, so I can imagine how tough this is. Folks, the organization is Violent Crime Survivors, vcsurvivors.org. Please go there, whether you agree or disagree. Get both sides of this issue, because this bill will quite likely come up for a vote on the floor, we think. Michelle Voigt and Jen Lawler, thank you so much for coming on today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Take care now.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll be in touch. All right, folks, there you go. Man, oh, man. Listen, if you want to allow people to continue with their lives and remove some barriers to getting an apartment, to getting a loan, to getting a mortgage, to being able to do things, and you're talking about some misdemeanors or low-level felonies, I think most people, as Jennifer and Michelle just said, we're okay with that. But when you start to really go into some low- and mid-level felonies, and the fact that we're going to treat this now as these things never happened? That's what the old Soviet Union used to do in the era of Joe Stalin. You became a non-person. If you came out against the state, you were literally wiped from history. Any references to you? And I don't think that's a harsh comparison. And again, we just heard from Jen and Michelle, and you've heard from legislators about this too. It's one thing to tell people, okay, we're going to give you a second chance here. You know, we're going to give you a second chance off of these misdemeanors and low-level felonies. But to say that all the records of them, or the easily accessible records, the evidence has to be tossed aside, that's just asinine. I don't care, you know, to what extent you want equity or you want this justice or that justice. You don't just say stuff didn't happen. If we're going down that lane, we're in deep fertilizer.